Welcome everybody. We haven't got a lot of time. We've got about 55 minutes. Sorry we started late. Just running over, talking to Dan Hobbs. Don't know how I feel about that really, but that's a 55 minute discussion for another time. Anywho, so welcome to the criminal justice system session. We've got 55 minutes. We have two excellent speakers. Just in terms of layout, so we've got about 15 minutes per speaker, and then we're going to have about 10 minutes of Q&As. Please post your questions in the chat function. If you just see at the bottom of your screen, you'll be able to get to that. And then I'll just moderate and ask the speakers those questions. Without further ado, let me introduce our two speakers and just say, first of all, we thank you to Carson for coming at the last minute. We had Roxy Ligan, who is the director. She's the director of a NGO called Kids of Colour in Manchester, which is really good. I'm going to post the Twitter in the chat. They work with educating children about racism, providing a platform for young people about how to tackle personal racism and systemic racism. They're doing really good stuff. Unfortunately, she couldn't come. So that's why you have three men on the panel, but we'll stay in contact with her as well. Anywho, so our two speakers today are Charles Critchlow and Carson Cole Arthur. Charles was a police officer for over 30 years in Greater Manchester Police. He was elected president of the National Black Police Association, and he served this role for 4 years. He's an experienced community organizer in the Manchester area where he lives. And he's been instrumental in supporting and developing numerous community organizations in that time. He's a graduate of the University of Manchester School of Law, and he has a master's in criminology. And his research focused on measures to reduce serious violence. He is also an independent special advisor to the recently concluded Tutu Foundation, into institutional racism at the Westway Trust in North Kensington. Our second speaker is Carson Cole Arthur. Can you give us a wave, Carson? There we are. Studying his MPhil in criminology at Birkbeck University, London School of Law. He's supported by the Economic and Social Research Council, and he is researching into the inquest of Black British people killed in police custody. Focus on accountability, testimony, memory, and racial violence. Yes, so I just want to start with you, Charles, and to get your thoughts and reflections about what happened in the United States with the murder of George Floyd, and what this can tell us about the UK.
Well, thanks, Jerome. And before I say anything, I just want to recognize that we lost two young men in our community to violence in the last 48 hours, and I know our community is in mourning, and I just really wanted to recognize that before we said anything. So anything that we say, I hope it will be a tribute to bringing about peace and justice in our communities. So, George Floyd, I had a number of reflections on what happened in Minneapolis, but one of the things in relation to British policing that struck me was that within 48 hours, the chief of police in Minneapolis. He fired those four officers. They were fired from the force. And what that did, that was significant, because that's never happened before. And two, it allowed those officers to be exposed to, the system of justice, or what there is of a system of justice in America. And so the police unions were not able to wrap themselves around those officers. And that was very, very different from anything that we've seen in America, notwithstanding the gruesomeness of the actual killing of George Floyd. But it struck me that in here in the United Kingdom, that had that exact situation that occurred in any of the 43 forces in England, that there is not a single chief constable that would have had the authority to fire any of those four officers. And you need to let that sink in for a minute. Now, some people have said this. Some people will say, well, we've got an entirely different system here and we've got processes, etc. But what a similar thing would have happened is that the Police Federation and others would have wrapped themselves around those officers, and it gets caught up in the whole system that often works against justice. So those were some of my thoughts. The other thought I had was that I remember I said this on my channel. I remember the very first day that I joined the police back in 1990, and within 10 minutes, I heard the word nigger. And this was by the supervising officer. This was my first experience. But what was interesting was that there were about a dozen people in the room and nobody challenged this. And nobody in authority challenged it. It was left for me to challenge it. And I've been challenging ever since then. Now, what we saw in Minneapolis was not just the fact that this guy was literally knee to death, but these officers were standing around, not challenging, not doing anything, not intervening. And I think therein lies a big part of the problem within British policing as well. It's not just what happens on the streets, but it's what happens in the boardrooms where strategies are developed, is that people do not intervene because there's a lot of inappropriateness that occurs at the policy-making level within policing. And I think that inaction, that is a big part of the problem. So those were some of my early reflections.
Thank you very much for that, Charles. I just wanted to follow up and ask you, one of the themes that I've heard you pick up before is this idea of radical transparency. I just wondered if you could expand on that and what do you think we could do for more accountability?
Well, basically what I have set out, and I hope this will be helpful, because the cry, out there is, we want justice, no peace, and that there needs to be changed. We need reform. But what I set out, and this is based on my experience within policing and the criminal justice system, and more to the point, really, my experience within our community, because that's where I've worked from, really, is that we need radical transparency insofar as policing is concerned. Now, if you look at what's happening in America, well, what's happening here is smart cameras, smartphones have basically revolutionized our ability to observe police behavior on the streets. But I think we need a similar transparency in police boardrooms. So, for example, police officers are required by under the Equality Act. They have a duty around race equality, for example, and they will produce a race equality strategy. But there is no transparency around how the police go about, implementing this. There is absolutely no transparency. So I think the time has come really for, there are many areas of police activity, particularly strategically, that I see no reason why the public using technology and not able to actually be present and be able to observe how things are done. So I think we need some radical transparency. I think we need accountability. Real accountability. Who's policing the police? I'm arguing that it can no longer be left to the police themselves. That I would propose, for example, that what you might understand to be sort of like internal affairs, or what is known as police professional standards, that should be taken completely out of the hands of the police and made to be truly independent. And that goes for the, what used to be IPCC. I think something entirely independent needs to be put in place. Because essentially what happens is that we allow the police to mark their own homework. So that needs to change. I've got 5 points here. I don't know if you want me to run through them and then we can pick up the conversation. Or did you want to come in?
I wanted to ask just a quick question, a legal question. So we've only got about 5 minutes before we have to go on to, before we go on to Carson.
Oh, right. No problem. Yeah, go on.
And the question I want to ask is, it's being asked across all the panels. It's a legal question.
Okay.
And, you know, we know the stats. We've seen, you know, the David Lammy review, the race disparity audit, and everyone's asking what now. And the framing which we're, you know, kind of bringing to this conference is, in light of these racial disparities, mm-hmm. what can the law do, and what would a duty to tackle these racial disparities look like? Would that be useful in your experience? I'll just give you about 4 or 5 minutes for that.
Yeah, I think we were slightly ahead of that. Yeah, I think that would be incredibly useful. But I think we need to go further than that, because we've already got duties placed upon the police to do certain things. But what I'm saying is that we implement these duties, but we allow the police to mark their own homework. And what we need is a proper regime of, well, then my next point was around scrutiny. So yes, have a duty to reduce disparity, but it needs to be properly scrutinized. Now we have a bizarre situation where we allow the police to pick and choose who will scrutinize their performance in many of these areas. Now, what I would propose is that the government would legislate and establish a professional body of scrutineers who are independent and professional in the area of equal justice. And this should not be ex-police officers and people who have been in the system. I think that needs to be aware. So that needs to happen. So it's not, no, it wouldn't be a case of sort of like hand-picked people from independent advisory groups who come along and just tick things off, yeah? It would be professional scrutineers. Just moving on quickly onto another point, because people talk a lot about training. I think that police recruitment, training, and those areas, and you know, there will be a lot of resistance, all those areas need to be taken off of the police. And so recruitment, training, development, etc., these things should be completely separate from the police. The police should not be left to train and develop police, because all we're doing is producing the same old, yeah? And I actually think that's something that could work hand in hand with some of these other proposals. So there needs to be a real holistic approach. And finally, I think there needs to be reparatory justice. Quite simply, in this moment, I would argue that the police need to come to reckoning. I mean, clearly from what we've seen with what's happened in the past in terms of criminalization and labeling of many of our communities. And you can apply all these duties, but if we don't come to reckoning with what we've done to communities, then we're just going to build on very, very shaky foundations. So those are my 5 points. I've put that together in something of a personal manifesto. And I hope that that could be the basis of a discussion as to how we move forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Charles. Definitely look forward to discussing that. You know, manifesto, I think, is very important in these times. Just wanted to pass on to you, Carson, and to get your reflections, and if you could tell us about your research and what you've picked up on with regards to criminal justice system and the kind of wider themes that are apparent within it.
Yes, hi. Good morning, everyone. So yes, my research that I'm currently doing as part of my MPhil at Birkbeck University is looking into the inquests of Black British people who've been killed in police custody. And I'm looking particularly at the coroner's court, which is the legal procedures of in which an inquest is carried out. And an inquest is, to put it simply, a legal investigation into the circumstances of a death that is violent or unnatural or unexplained. And so the points that Charles was making just a few moments ago about accountability and transparency, these are particular mechanisms, legal mechanisms, but I'm looking more in terms of how those principles become part of legal decision making, how they create evidence and facts, and how these sort of legal justifications come to be expressed by the police and also other judicial officials, how those legal justifications become, we could say, commonsensical and used to justify for the killing of Black people by the police, where it seems outside the remit of a criminal jurisdiction. And how it's made to seem quite natural, so to speak. Perhaps to kind of bring in this discussion about criminal justice and the Winross scandal, I thought I'd just speak a little bit further about how we could think about the criminal justice system, one that is not confined and centralized to the police, but if we kind of open up our ideas of other ways that the government, police, in particular Black communities, and so this would include other penal and legal institutions such as immigration tribunals and detention centers, probation. Youth justice sometimes is removed sometimes from these discussions. And here, when we kind of branch out the criminal justice system to include these different institutions, we come to maybe think about the public and private sphere. And then we can even go a little bit deeper. We could look at the societal institutions of this, such as health, social security, and the benefit system. And as we saw and witnessed with the Windrush scandal, or however you want to may put it, one of the particular issues was about sharing data, how the Home Office and NHS would share data between each other. And this is quite a common strategy into the 21st century of data and policing in particular. If we were to go back to policing, we could look at how the gang matrix is utilized by the police, how that is used disproportionately against young Black people. Those are suspected criminals, but then how this also brings into the net of their family and their relatives and friends. With COVID-19, we've kind of seen that exasperated and intensified with young Black people being continued to be stop and search, how they're disproportionately issued penalties for breaching measures put into place to protect the public from the virus. And we're seeing a widening gap in injustices, not just in the criminal justice system, but again to other societal areas such as education, access to health, and so forth. One particular political analysis that we may bring into ways of trying to hold the state to account is going a little bit beyond maybe just a race relations a framework of looking at this, but looking at how the British nation state is restructuring itself. And we should also bear in mind that this is coming into a period of Brexit. For the Tory government, there's a particular opportunity for them to reorient and reassemble how they seek to maintain, manage, and regulate capital and labor and services. And there's a particular reconfiguration, I think, of the nation state that is not just parallel, but very connected to Windrush and the post-war period of the late 40s and early 50s with present day. The Tory government and Johnson is pushing very much a narrative of this being the war and people being on the front lines, and who once again is coming here to rescue and save this empire. It is Black people. It is people from the Caribbean, from Africa. These are the people that they're looking towards to save their political infrastructure. So that sort of analysis would help us to kind of move beyond, say, terms such as institutional ignorance that was used in the Windrush Lessons Review, and really return us back to questions of institutional racism, but also to consider about state racial violence, where we look at maybe not the most graphic spectacles of violence, such as kneeling on a young Black person by the police, which doesn't just happen in the US, but also here. I mean, in a few weeks' time, towards the end of July, will be the third year anniversary of the killing of Rashawn Charles, who was restrained by a police officer in Dalston. But also to think about state racial violence in terms of maybe the case of, for example, Bella Munjinga, who was spat at as she was working as a transport clerk at a Victoria station. And to look at the ways that the government have tried to distance themselves from protecting Black key workers such as herself. While it's integral that we have, and important we have different mechanisms and forums such as inquests or even maybe public inquiries, we should also be very mindful of the way that the state can use those forums to create and produce narratives that sustain and continue their regulation and their administration and control of Black communities. Just lastly, maybe to bring back the conversation in regards to Windrush, maybe we can think about the ways we can organize as a community around testimony. We've been hearing testimonies this morning, accounts about the Windrush scandal. There have been many testimonies, individual testimonies, but perhaps one way in which we can try and move pressure and resist against the government is to think about ways in which we collect these testimonies so they don't seem fragmented, individual, but that there's a way to bring them together, to look at patterns, to look at the systemic way violence is meted out, so that it's not just one voice, but the voice of many, and many voices being one and strong. So perhaps in the Q&A we can discuss about these different issues further.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Thank you so much for that, Carson. I think, you know, definitely in we're in kind of political fertile ground here in the UK, at least with this Conservative Party before COVID, you know, managed to reorientate itself. And this presents a big opportunity, you know, with COVID and Black Lives Matter and how you kind of wage almost a culture war. You know what I mean? And of course, it's going to be race relations. And you already see the start of that from the Conservative government. And, you know, thank you for, I think testimony is really important as well, how we look at it. I had a quick follow-up question to you before we go into the Q&A, because I'd really like to bring some questions in from the floor. What do you think, you made your first point about this holistic approach, which is needed? Let's get your point. Yeah, it's, you know, in the States, the Minnesota Police Department, as I understand it, that was almost the baby, Obama's baby, of the kind of procedural fairness approach. Like, all those reforms had been tried. And now the narrative seems to be shifting in the States towards talking of defunding. We need a police, we need a public safety approach. How do you see that fitting in? And how do you think we can kind of use that as an opportunity? What you've seen?
Yes, I mean the discussion in the US, discussions having in the US are very interesting. Going as you say, mentioning about defunding the police, I think there's what's a complicated one. Yeah, Obama and his reforms, how they seem to not have worked or been successful in some particular manner. It's arguable whether they were even designed in the first place to have the best interests of Black communities in the US. The talk of defunding, I mean, one thing to kind of bear in mind with the US compared to the UK is that the US, their police departments are they have more of a closer relationship with the military, and the funding that they receive is huge. It's gastronomical. It's more than schools and hospitals. It's slightly different here in the UK, where the funding is essentially coming from central government. So the US are discussing about the funding in the UK. I think it's also important to to talk about the funding as well, because of course there's private companies are also involved in different operations by the UK police. And as I mentioned, you know, one is data. A lot of companies are involved in that. And then we can also perhaps talk about Serco, these private corporations that kind of also fulfill kind of policing functions as well. I've kind of lost that a little bit because there was so much there. What was what was the second part of the question?
Based on your research,
yeah,
and what you've been looking at, what do you think that we can do as a community to organize around these racial disparities more? Got a couple of minutes before we'd like to go into Q&As.
Yeah, sure. I think for me, one of the most important things is to really talk about the deaths and killings in police custody here in the UK. It has been fantastic to see a conversation about police happening again in the UK. The worry is that it's very US centric, and only a couple of weeks ago there was a death in police custody of a young black man whose name was Simone Francis, who died in Devon. You know, these things are happening very often, very frequently. We don't talk about that. So I think one is to actually talk about that. There's ways in which we can archive, tell these stories about the history, but also the present. But yeah, my research, I mean, this is one of the questions I grapple with, really, is how to educate and to bring this knowledge, but also to do it in a caring way that is respectful and a way that is mourning also the dead that we do lose. So perhaps one way to start and think about organizing around issues such as deaths in police custody and dispossession that many experience from the Windrush scandal is to start with questions of how we care for one another, how we help ourselves through periods of mourning, and how we look out for each other, and then move forward from there, I think.
Thank you for that. That's really powerful. We've got some questions here from the floor. Got a question from Elaine. Take a couple of these. Should we be encouraging our young black men and women to join the police force in its current position or state? Got a question from Sister Wendy. Why is the police investigating themselves when they've committed crimes? And a question from Sam. We've got a lot. Might come to that one afterwards. Yeah, just want to pick up on those two.
The first one thank you for the question, Elaine. If I understand you correctly, should we be encouraging young black men or young black people to join the police? It's a moral question, I guess. Let's be clear that, you know, we live in a racist society. Yeah. So racism, you know, cuts across, you know, all the professions. We, you know, when we look at health, the legal profession, housing, etc. So I would be very, very reluctant, having spent 30 years within the criminal justice system, to say to any person not to join the profession. But what I would say is that we've got to encourage people you know, to be very, very wide-eyed. And, it, you know, when they're thinking about these types of careers, because undoubtedly you will be exposed to, you know, I would say moral danger, where you have to be very, very principled in these organizations, because, you know, you could be drawn into things that, you know, that you may not actually had intended to be drawn into. So this is something, and this is why when I was talking about training and how that should be taken away from the police, is that we need to be in a position where we can train and get and develop professionals that actually, and it comes to the point that Carlson just made then about caring for people, that we should be educating people for true public service. And the nub of that is about actually caring for people and people's lives. And so that will be the whole systemic change that I think is needed to bring policing into the 21st century. If I can just make a little small point on the defunding thing, you know, I actually think that the defund the police thing is actually a very interesting one, and it's probably a really good place to start the conversation when we look at how do we rethink what this thing we call policing and public protection should look like in the 21st century. So I agree with that. And I think what we may end up with is precisely some of the things that we're talking about here. Is there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the policing realm that costs, that we spend millions of pounds on, that actually can be done elsewhere within the public realm, but can be more effective and will actually be more justice given.
Thank you for that. I had a question, I think Carlson might be more up your street, about from Sam about Serco, the role of Serco and the outsourcing privatization of state functions. Has this led to less oversight in the present model of capital? I noticed the probation service has been brought back to government control. Why did this occur? So I guess it's a question about the state and private entities.
Yes, certainly. Well, from what I'm aware of, I may be mistaken here, so don't kind of hold me to this, but from what I'm aware of, I think there's a partial nationalization of the probation system, if I'm not mistaken. And I think to quickly answer one part of that question, is that it came about mainly because the Tory government realized that one of the previous justice ministers had done such a awful job, even by their standards, that they had to kind of intervene. And that was Gardley, if I'm pronouncing his name right. So that was the government kind of making that particular intervention, I suppose, of them wanting to really kind of not have private enterprise be part of the criminal justice system. Serco has received many complaints. There's been, I think, some investigations into how they've kind of mishandled the probation system, yet they're still continually rewarded contracts by the government. And I believe they're even kind of part of, I'm not too sure what the development of this is, but they're definitely part of the government's plan of tracking fast and tracking of COVID-19 and their tracking system. So again, data coming back into this. Whether this has meant that scrutiny and oversight is kind of taken away from the public because private enterprise is involved and these corporations involved. I mean, to a certain extent, yes and no. It hasn't been the case that recently, for example, there's been less inquests or investigations or reviews for that matter into these particular operations and initiatives done by either the police or private enterprise. And this kind of echoes what I was kind of saying before about how sometimes these reviews are set up, but they don't really kind of properly, well, their analysis doesn't go, you know, deep enough to actually challenging the entire system itself. It's there to mainly kind of sustain the capital or sustain the legal justification for something. One quick thing also just to mention about the funding. This, I think, should be something cautionary in terms of discussion in the US, but also here in the UK of any discussion about the funding. What I worry about is what's talked about the funding is talked about redistribution. Mm-hmm. And so the problem I find is that in these discussions, it goes from, oh, well, the police shouldn't have this money, but these other public services should have that money to fulfill functions that we were giving to the police. And the danger in that is then you have public roles, civic roles, then being changed into enforcement roles. And we kind of see that in schools and in particular in universities where your teacher suddenly becomes a potential immigration officer. Questions they ask about your development in education seemingly then become questions about whether you belong in this country, whether you could be a threat to others or yourself. So discussions about the funding, it can get a bit too financial and not talk about the kind of political and ethical implications of where this money is being allocated.
Thank you very much for that. The last point about, you know, that's where it gets political at that point of redistribution. And I think that's where, you know, we need to be as a community and asking those political questions about where that funding goes. Just to go back to you, Charles, got a question from Lorna about the role of BAPA, the Black Association.
Sorry.
Let me get that one out. Will BAPA lead talks with police on the changes needed when dealing with African Caribbean communities? How do we address people coming to police force? And there's another question, could I put two in there for you, Charles? Is that right? Was one of the themes, one of these five themes you're talking about is oversight.
Yes.
Know, Sam says, we're given the impression that oversight involves independent people. Is this not the case? What's the role of the local authority? People not elected.
Well, okay. Let's tackle that one. We now have, we've moved away from police authorities who used to have the function of holding the chief constables to account. So now we've moved to elected police and crime commissioners. And in the case of London and Manchester, it's the elected mayor essentially becomes the office of the police and crime commissioner. And there are a lot of problems with this. I mean, for one, it makes this role kind of ideologically driven, often, you know, in around the country, because they're elected. You know, these are conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrats, whatever. So that's one problem. And secondly, in terms of holding the chief constable to account, I don't see that they have the competency, actually, or even the capacity, certainly from my observation, to really get down and ask the critical questions, certainly around, you know, the issues that Carsten and I have been speaking about. It just doesn't happen, actually. And you know, I that's why I propose that this really needs a complete rethink in terms of how those questions are asked. You know, I think in Manchester, for example, and we had a death in over in Bury. I forget the name. I don't want to go the name wrong. It's a young girl who died about a year ago. And there are a lot of questions about the circumstances surrounding this and how the police investigated this particular death. And it's only since George Floyd that the mayor of Manchester, who is the police and crime commissioner, has started asking questions about this. So it becomes very politically driven. You know, who's making, you know, who's where the noise is coming from, and so on. So I don't really have a lot of confidence in the current system of oversight of policing, and that's something we need to be talking about much more. The other question was around the Black Police Association. Now, I'm no longer in policing. I do think those organizations have a role to play in terms of well, they can be a form of, if you like, internal accountability, because the very reason why those organizations emerged in policing in the first place was that, from my perspective, was that there was a big concern around deaths in custody and stop and search and all of this. And they had no voice, because the Police Federation, who have got the monopoly on representing officers by law, because police officers, they're not allowed to join unions, the Black officers had no voice, had no way of speaking out. And so they had to organize themselves into a network so that they can speak truth to power and let people know what they really thought about what was going on in policing. So yes, I think they can play a role, but I think they have to work much more in conjunction with the communities, and we see a lot of evidence of that, but it needs to happen much more.
I'm on mute.
All right, so
I've got about 5 minutes. Final question from Peter. Peter's actually sent it to me privately, but I can read it out because it's meant to go to the group. Because I think it touched on both your areas of expertise. Can this transition from a social control society to a social investment society occur under a conservative government? How do we address this and help push changes from the grassroots levels? I'm really interested in your responses, especially with, you know, we've got the Police Crime Commissioner elections next year.
Do you want me to address that?
Yes, please, Carsten, if you'd like to go after, is that right?
No, please. Yeah, I think, yeah, Charles, I'm interested to hear what you have to say as well, Chris, please.
Well, I think the short answer is no. But actually, I'm not sure that, I mean, take Greater Manchester, for example. You know, we've been under, Labour control from literally top to bottom. They run the show in Greater Manchester, and I don't really see any evidence of any significant shift ideological shift towards, you know, the type of model that we, you know, this social investment. I just don't see the evidence of it, both in terms of the conservative or Labour. So I think this is, ultimately, I think this is up to the people to coalesce and to campaign, you know, and to make the voices heard. And, you know, because often, say, for example, in the case of policing, you know, police leaders love to quote Sir Robert Peel, and they say, well, the public is the police, and the police is the public. They love to say that. But actually, when you look at the way things are done, there's very little evidence that type of philosophy works its way out in reality, certainly in you know, in terms of the communities that, you know, we're concerned about. And so so my answer is, no, I don't think that's gonna, we're not going to get anything from this government, but I'm sorry, I'm not sure that the Labour government, certainly on, you know, where it's gone now, perhaps under Jeremy Corbyn, perhaps the types of things that Corbyn was enunciating, perhaps it might have been a chance that something could have emerged there, yes. But I doubt whether we could expect either a conservative or this type of Labour government to set out that type of thing. Yeah. So it's going to have to come from the people.
Thanks for that, Carson. Do you have any thoughts?
I don't think it's going to come from the Conservatives, and I'm very dubious and skeptical about the Labour Party as well doing that as well. I'm thinking about, like, whether, I mean, I kind of hear perhaps the the kind of the concern about the questioner had with kind of going from towards kind of a social investment. Again, I'm not, for me personally, an investment brings up just reminds me about money and capital and having to prove one's worth and value, and these things kind of being predicated on having to produce things and be successful, and that's, of course, you know, is important to make those type of investments. But does that hold a community together in the long run? I'm not too sure. There's definitely this definitely is something that we as a people lead on this, and so what I'm trying to think about at the moment, what I'm learning constantly, even through this conference today, is how we push and go forward with the things that we want to see in our community, in our areas, in society, in the world, without it being dependable on who's in government and who's not. Quite simply, the government does not care about us. So let us try and do what we want to do with or without them. Sooner or later, they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to listen to us. So, and I think it kind of just starts with the small things, the things that we can do together, in our family, in our friend circles, and really try and build on that, for that to, you know, lead into a movement, and a movement of our own, really.
Thank you so much. We've been here for 55 minutes. We've got music back in the main conference room. Music is provided by Mega Dread sound system. And then we're going to go back to the plenary. Thank you everyone so much for joining.
Thank you.
I think it's huge when you're dealing with these problems and we're speaking across these themes about how we get organized. And thank you so much for your contributions, Charles. I think terms of reference, how we understand something going forward of 5 points, terms of transparency, accountability, scrutiny, education, reparation is really useful for us to organize around. And I think using the techniques which Carson's researched and spoken about can be tools as well in terms of thinking about testimony, archive, and the political context of race relations and where we are. So thank you very much. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions in the chat. I will save all of these. The next part of this project going forward, probably towards the autumn, is doing more of a research problem and a research project and reconvening in the autumn. So we'll keep everyone up to date and try and get those questions answered. So yeah, thank you very much.